Just before we, in this very crowded attendance session, with some very suspicious usual suspects here today, can I just give you a couple of club announcements? We have next week, on the same day, Monday, we have a talk by Ben Simpendorfer of the Royal Bank of Scotland, owned by the British government, who will be talking on the new Silk Road, how a rising Arab world is turning away from the West and rediscovering China. And also, I just want to take this opportunity to remind members that the closing date for the FCC ballot is exactly a month away on May 20th. This is Hong Kong, so it's not a one man, one vote, of course. And the third announcement is that club has decided that anybody who leaves their telephone on during this speech is garrotted. So please remember that. And on that happy thought, let me introduce our speaker today. Mike Rouse probably needs no introduction, but that won't stop me. He is quite definitely not the person who was in mind when they created the prototype of the UNIFIT civil servant. And that's a compliment, incidentally. And to prove that, he went on to be the only civil servant in Hong Kong who has ever successfully not only taken the government to court seeking a judicial review of a disciplinary action, but in fact won his case in court. But there are a number of other things that he did before getting to that point. And of course, before becoming a civil servant, he had a perfectly respectable job. As you can see from the shirt that he's wearing, he was in fact a journalist. But we're very fortunate to have Mike here today to talk about his... I'm not going to say what he's going to talk about, but we're very happy to have you here, Mike.
Thanks, Steve. I think probably the most unusual civil servant here is me, an unusual suspect. Yes, as one of the founder members of the Hong Kong Journalists Association in 1973, the media has always had a special place in my heart. So I thought this morning when I was dressing up, I had a choice between my Administrative Service Association shirt and my star shirt, and I thought it was entirely appropriate to wear the star today. A sad, lamented newspaper. I spent the last 8.5 years making unscripted speeches all over the world, but in honor of today's occasion, I've actually prepared something, as you can see. And I thought perhaps if I talked about... the best part of this is actually going to be the Q&A, isn't it? Let's face it. I'm sitting around this room, and already people are saying, why doesn't he shut up and let us ask questions? No, you're going to have to hear a little bit first, and then we'll have the Q&A. But it comes with a health warning. I always tell the complete truth. So if you really don't want to know the answer, be very careful how you phrase the question. I thought I'd start with actually my first morning in the administrative service of the Hong Kong government, as it then was, when I managed to have 3 different postings in 20 minutes. This began when I went to the office of the Principal Assistant Secretary, whose name I will reveal later, a young local officer who's since gone on to higher things. He picked up the phone and told the Secretary for Security that he had his new Assistant Secretary, who was to take over the Vietnamese refugee schedule. And of course, I don't know what all that was said. I only heard one end of the conversation. But it went something like, oh, but nobody told me. Well, this is most embarrassing. I have the officer here with me now. Oh. Whereupon he put the phone down and said, asked me to wait outside. Turned out the post was so important that it had been deleted the week before. And after about 10 minutes sitting outside, drinking a cup of coffee, a secretary came out and asked if I could drive. And I said, yes, I could drive. suggested Miss Biedig, apparently at that point, for a few seconds, I was going to be the assistant district officer in Sai Kung. But finally at 9:20, I went back in and received my first posting. I was made the assistant district officer, Islands. And that's an interesting introduction to this very efficient government, which I've been pleased to be a member of for so many years. And I thought also I should, even though it's right in the early remarks, I should also talk about my last posting. Because after the report by the consultants that recommended the creation of Invest Hong Kong, the civil service approached someone in the private sector and asked him if he would be the first director general, because the feeling was we needed more private sector input, more private sector mindset to encourage businessmen to invest in Hong Kong. And that person had the good sense to say no. They then approached a civil servant, another potential candidate, and asked him if he would be the director general, and he said no, also showing good sense. And then they called me in and told me that I was their first choice. But of course, after 20 years in the government, I knew the rules of the game by this time, and I said how honoured I was. Not knowing that I knew both of the other two and that they'd been offered the job and why they turned it down. Take what you can from those conversations. So what began in chaos ended with, how shall we put it, a certain amount of economy with the truth. In fact, I think we have a former secretary for the civil service here with us today. He's hiding behind the pillar over there. Hi, WK, how's it going? do you remember that conversation? He's pleading not guilty. I've tried it. It doesn't work. I must say, a couple of the episodes in my time, I'm not going to try and out Austin Mr. Coates here, but there were a couple of very interesting experiences that I had that sort of really opened my eyes. I remember one of them involved helicopter warning signs. Now, we had a lot of helipads in the outlying islands in those days because the medical services weren't that great and people always needed rescuing or emergency. And we decided that what we were going to do, someone had decided before I got there, to erect a lot of warning signs, one for each helipad site all around the islands district. There must have been 50 of these damn things. And they were made and delivered to the site and paid for, but not erected. And then there was a terrible storm, and they were all lost. Now, this presented to the bureaucracy an enormous problem, because someone had signed a receipt for these warning signs at the helipads, but they could no longer be found. And everyone lived in a panic until we realized that everyone knew what was going on in the real world. Helicopters landed at these places from time to time. They're rather noisy. You'd have to actually have been deceased not to detect one coming. And perhaps the absence of a warning sign was not that critical. And anyway, after about 5 years, we could pretend they'd weathered and needed replacing, and we could buy some new ones and put them up. So we realized then that the real problem existed only on the file. It wasn't a problem in the real world, but there was a problem with the paperwork. And I was corresponding on this subject with the New Territories Administration headquarters. And eventually a colleague, who I won't name, even though he is retired and living in a foreign country, I don't think you can be extradited for this, but eventually we solved the problem of the files. He wrote me a memorandum listing out all the questions that a diligent headquarters should send to a district office. He put a copy of that memo on his file. I then gave a comprehensive reply with all of the possible information that a dutiful district office should have at its disposal and send back. And I then very carefully put a copy of that memorandum on my file and destroyed the original. What this meant was that his file showed that he'd been conscientious and dutiful, and he put the file away in the storeroom, And my file showed that I'd been dutiful and conscientious. I put my file away in the storeroom, and the only way either of us was ever going to be caught is if somebody managed to get their hands on both files at the same time. That lesson stayed with me for a long time. And it was shortly after this that a very beautiful Chinese lady from Canada came into my office, because we used to have a day every week when we met the villagers. They didn't have to have an appointment. They could just walk in and queue up and see the district officer or any ADO. And she sat down in front of me and said, "I don't care what you say, I'm not digging him up." And of course, you know, I'm still fairly new in this job, but what? She said, he lived on the island for 60 years. He was held in very high esteem by all the villagers, and I'm not going to dig him up. And it turned out, when she sort of calmed herself down, I calmed herself, she had a letter. Now, we have a practice in Hong Kong, I think it's still the practice, whereby if you're a male descendant of a recognized pre-1898 village, descendant of the male, you have certain privileges, one of which is a small house, and one of which is a hillside burial. The trouble on Lama Island was that the villages did not predate 1898, but there was a custom of tolerating unlawful hillside burials of long-term residents, and they were all in the same place, and it didn't cause any trouble. And I sent for the file, because she'd taken the piece of paper. Apparently someone had ordered a notice to be placed on the headstone of her father's grave, saying that this body must be exhumed. And I read the file, and of course, what singled this grave out was that the headstone was much bigger than any of the others. So I said to the young lady, who spoke impeccable English, I said, "I think I see the problem now. What drew our attention to this particular grave was the excessive size of the headstone." And she said, no, he lived there for 60 years. He was widely respected, He's an integral part of the community. Everyone else buried in that location is also not entitled to hillside burial. Why are you saying that?" And I slightly rose from my seat and said, "What drew our attention to this grave was the excessive size of the headstone." And she said, no, "I've come all the way back from Canada." She said, I'm not digging him up. The family, the guy, well, I stood up at this point and said, "What drew our attention to this grave was the excessive size of the headstone." And finally she stopped talking and the wheel started to spin. And she said, "If we reduced the size of the headstone to the same as all the others, could you guarantee that you wouldn't dig him up?" I said, "Of course I cannot commit the government in this matter." Is that a good civil service answer? And she did reduce the size of the headstone, and after that we couldn't see it because it didn't stand out, you see. Problem solved. In the days when men were men. I know we're coming up to June the 4th, and I don't want to mock those events, but I do want to poke a little bit of fun at myself for a very, very small part, incident that happened to me that weekend. On June the I was then in the information section, which some of you remember, but yeah, Peter remembers me in that. And on the evening of 3rd of June, I drank a whole bottle of rather poor wine and went to bed with a terrible hangover and a thumping headache. And the phone rang at about 3 a.m., someone claiming to be a journalist from the UK. And he said, "Thanks for going in. I phoned the government house. No one will come to the phone. I phoned the chief secretary's residence. No one will come to the phone. I phoned GIS, the duty officer. We've got nothing to say. So I come to you." I said, I hadn't got a clue what this guy was talking about. I'm sitting up in bed in the middle of the night, completely pitch black, with the phone, and he's on about tanks. He's on about the governor. And he said, "What's the situation like in Hong Kong? Huh? Well, how are you feeling?" Fraught. I put the phone down. About 2 days later, the Morning Post had a collage of how the world responded. And there were snippets from all the newspapers all over the world. And one of the UK papers quoted a Hong Kong government spokesman as saying that the situation was fraught. Now, from this experience, I learned two very important lessons. Number one, no more cheap wine. And number two, when dealing with the media, when you haven't got a clue what they're talking about, keep your answers very short. I thought it was a very nice one. Some of the most fun I had in the last 28 years was cutting red tape as the first director in the Business and Services Promotion Unit, the BSPU, or as we used to call it, Bullshit Passes Upwards. I had a great time, and you find so many oddities. The old regulations for licensing restaurants used to insist that the tiles in the kitchen were white. They didn't have to be clean, but they had to be white. So pristine pink ones would not get you a restaurant license, but grubby old white ones, you were straight in. And I remember, because the guy from McDonald's actually produced a flow chart at one point which proved that it was impossible to get a restaurant license legally. He was a terribly, terribly nice chap, but very frazzled. But I think the best one on restaurant licensing was the one with the fridge in the Ritz-Carlton, which Martin Barrow told me about, because he actually went to look at it. Apparently, you must, to get your restaurant license, have a plan of where all of your equipment is going to be, together with a drawing prepared by a structural engineer to show that the floor loading is adequate in the place where that equipment is. Now, there was a surprise inspection of the Ritz-Carlton, and the health inspector noticed that a refrigerator had been moved from one side of the kitchen to the other. And the health inspector was demanding a new drawing prepared by a structural engineer to show that the floor could cope with the refrigerator in its new location. And Mr. Vines, who's involved in catering, has got a very rueful smile at this point. The problem was, this refrigerator was for holding cups of caviar. It was about this big, and you could carry it in the palm of your hand. But that didn't matter, because the regulation said that if you moved a piece of equipment, and refrigerator was listed as a piece of equipment, you needed approval in advance, and secondly, you needed a structural engineer to prepare a drawing showing that it was possible. There are so many examples of this in those years. I won't try and recall them all, because I want to get on to the questions in a minute. Perhaps one more area was investment promotion, which I just want to talk about the origin of the department. Investment promotion in Hong Kong used to be conducted by a unit in the industry department called the One Stock Unit. And I'm sure the people there are very conscientious and did a good job. The trouble was, our economy changed, but their instructions from their superiors didn't change. So the consultant's report in 1999 was asked the question, should we give the job of investment promotion to the TDC? It's a very legitimate question to ask, and the answer is no, we shouldn't. But the findings that the consultants brought back were five, and then they answered the specific question. The five findings they had were, number one, you've hired the wrong people. Number two, you've put some of them in the wrong place. Number three, you've given them the wrong assignment. Number four, for the last 10 years, you've been wasting your time. And the best one of all was number five, for the last 5 years, Hong Kong's investment promotion has been, and I quote, mildly counterproductive. And the only criticism of that consultant's report that I ever found came from Michael Enright, who some of you know, the professor, who criticized the word mildly. He's not mildly counterproductive. He said it's extremely counterproductive. And then when Donald got upset, he explained to Donald why it was extremely counterproductive. Basically, because all of our manufacturing had moved across the border, and that process was in fact accelerating at that time, to send people around the world encouraging manufacturers to come and set up in Hong Kong was going over rather oddly. People were listening to our representatives and saying, that's very interesting, thank you very much for coming. And then as soon as our guy left the room, looking at each other saying, what planet are these people from? Now, I never ever blame the people in the front line when that kind of situation arises. I still remember what the German description of the British Army in World War I was, and some of us are old enough to remember the Germans describing the British Army in World War I, lions led by donkeys. So what had happened over the life of the one-stop unit was that it began as very useful, it then became less useful, it then became useless, and it then became damaging. And the three Director Generals of Industry who presided over this descent were, of course, all subsequently promoted from D6 to Director at Point 8, and two of them actually went on from there to be minister. So I just thought it's a little snippet that you ought to be able to take away with you, as well as the wine and the food we've had today. I think I'll leave Disney to the Q&A, because I know Steve, who writes about it factually incorrectly all the time, well, he's the only person I know who actually follows Michael Eisner's line to take on that subject, which is, I'm sure, not what he did deliberately. And I'm also very keen to get something on post-service employment, but I think that's such a big topic, I'll leave that for the Q&A as well. I'll just have a word or two on Harbourfest. I'm writing a book. The book is called No Minister, and the subtitle is The True Story of Harbourfest. I think some of you have read about this in the Chinese media and also the British media. It, at the moment, has 16 chapters. I've written 9 and almost finished the 10th, and I have a work plan that should see it finished by sometime in June, at least the first draft, for comments. I suppose I have to show it to my wife. And I'll try and get an impartial reviewer as well, get some comments and put it up. The truth is that it was all political. It was a rule by the mob, and there was no attempt in the judicial, in the discipline process to be fair. I've actually got a memorandum from the Civil Service Bureau at one point that says fairness is not one of the criteria. You can't argue with that. No, you can't. The Secretary for the Civil Service, you see, decides whether or not you should be charged. He employs the prosecutor. He selects the judges. He has power of veto over your representative in the hearing. And then he or she, he alone, decides whether to accept the findings of the discipline committee. I think the procedures were actually designed in the 1850s to cope with the Indian Mutiny. Because you're not there for a trial, you're there to plead guilty straight away and then throw yourself on the mercy of the court. And if you don't do that, all hell breaks loose. Hell, in my case, took the form of $6 million in expenditure, mostly legal fees, to pursue this case to an end. My lawyers tell me I'm likely to get back about half of that if I'm lucky. So for the privilege of proving the chief executive, the chief secretary, the secretary for civil service, and by implication, the secretary for justice and the financial secretary to be a bunch of wallies, the price of that has been about $3 million from my personal account. And worth every penny, that's what I say, worth every penny. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that value for money speech, Mike. As usual, we have questions. Try and get as many in as possible. If you can give your name and, if you dare to, your affiliation, I'll be very happy to take those questions. Maybe I can just start the questioning, because it's prerogative of whoever's sitting here, and just ask you, I mean, very simply, do you regard, or do you still regard, Harbour Fest as having been a success, and if that isn't the case, who actually was to blame?
It, as an event, it had, well, it's like the parson's egg. There were good bits and there were bad bits. Some of the concerts were absolutely fantastic. People still stop me in the street and talk about the Rolling Stones. Yeah, happened last month. And Santana. And who was that? The old guy from Canada, Neil Young. People... See, both Neil and I have memory issues. So the concerts themselves were fabulous. And the audiences... Of course, you build the venue for the most popular event, which is why we often felt that pictures of empty seats for some of the less popular artists were nonsensical. What did that prove? It just proved that they were less popular than some of the others. But politically, it was a disaster for a number of reasons. But the two fundamental faults, and of course for the detail, you'll have to buy a copy of the book. The two fundamental faults. It was too big to organise with that short period of time. The first concert was held less than 100 days after the approval was given. Whereas for an event on that scale, anyone in the entertainment industry will tell you, you need a lead time of 12 to 15 months. It simply wasn't there. It was too big. It should have been much smaller. It should have been with a much smaller government subsidy, correspondingly. It should have been held in an existing venue. Hell, they imported the stage from Australia, came in a container, and was erected in about 10 days or something. So certain aspects of the logistics were miraculous, but political problem. And the other thing was that the nature of the government's involvement, where the government was putting in, at one point, nearly 90% of the total cost, and eventually it worked out to be about 60%, 60-something percent, of the total cost. The government should have been a co-organiser. But that option was specifically ruled out by Anthony Leung. It's in writing. The government is not to organise it. The government is not to co-organise it. The government is to be, and I quote, a sponsor only. Now, we in Invest Hong Kong knew exactly what sponsorship means because we sponsor dozens of events every year. We did before Harbourfest and we have since Harbourfest. You have an agreed fee and you have an agreed package of benefits. And your job is to make sure that the package of benefits from the sponsorship deal are delivered. And they were delivered. But later, all the criticism, I've just read again. You see how sad life in retirement is. I've just read the audit report, the report of the so-called independent panel of inquiry, where Henry got two of his best friends to find that Henry had nothing to do with it, and the Public Accounts Committee report on Harbourfest. They all of the valid criticisms, and many of them are, of me, was because I failed to act like a co-organiser. I failed to fulfill the duties of a co-organiser. So they're all true. Those criticisms are all true. They're all valid. But the instruction in writing, and luckily we kept a copy, and luckily we didn't allow that to be altered 9 months later, unlike some of the other correspondents, it shows quite clearly what the directive to me was. So do I regret? No. I regret the original decision. And especially those two aspects of it. But they led inevitably to what happened.
Okay. Right in the back.
My name's Paul Surtees. My question, Mike, is about the remuneration paid to your former colleagues, senior civil servants. It was announced recently that our undersecretaries, heads of department, and, of course, ministers, each receive much more in salary than the British Prime Minister, and more than most Prime Ministers in most countries of the world. Now, do you believe that by giving such generous compensation packages to our civil servants, we therefore get the best possible public servants?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question because those people are not civil servants. They are not members of the civil service. They are a political layer that has been placed on top of the civil service. And whether we've got the best people for the money is a matter of opinion. I don't know. You could perhaps ask the immigration officer where he, what he's done with Greg's name card. No civil servant could have done that to another civil servant, because you would have embarrassed that civil servant in the conduct of his duty. It had to be someone who hadn't grown up in the civil service tradition. I think, by and large, after 28 years and all the pluses and minuses, I think we have it right that we keep the government small. The government should do the things that need doing for the benefit of the community that the community cannot spontaneously do itself. So we should have a police force. We should have a fire brigade. We should do things. But one of the things we should also do in other areas is to create an environment such that the private sector does as much as possible. So I think, by and large, we've got it right, and I think we must absolutely not go back to the pre-1974 days of rampant corruption in Hong Kong. And I think the price of that is a well-paid civil service. So we should have a well-paid civil service. I'm not sure about this political layer on the top. I've yet to see, after nearly 7 years of it, where is the value add, frankly. By the way, the three reports that I mentioned, the audit report and the independent panel and the Public Accounts Committee, all have something in common. There is not a single word in any of them about the minister for Harbourfest.
Gentleman in the corner there.
Mike, my name is Chris Potts. You perhaps are in a unique position to compare the before with the after in terms of the colonial civil service and the post-colonial. What, if any, are the perceived or actual differences between the two? Are they all a bunch of wallies?
I never actually saw that much difference, certainly in the posts that I held. I mean, it was a big issue coming up to 1997, and a lot of question marks in people's minds. But 1998, 1999, the things I had been doing before, I just kept on doing. I didn't get queries from Beijing any more than I'd got. Actually, we used sometimes to get queries from London about what are you doing. There'd be telegrams would arrive from the Foreign Office overnight, and you spend half the day rushing around trying to draft an answer. But I never got any questions like that from Beijing. And I found that when we started to work together with our mainland counterparts on things like investment promotion, that we would do a joint promotion, that is Hong Kong and Shenzhen going together to sell a package, a location, that they were very cooperative, very friendly, very respectful, very professional. And the Ministry of Commerce in Beijing, in fact, had a much better grasp of what Invest Hong Kong was doing than the Commerce, Industry and Technology Bureau in Lower Albert Road. Well, she's not in Lower Albert Road, is it?
Upper. Jake.
Mike, you were our government's chief negotiator for the deal with Disney on the Disney park. And the general opinion these days is that it's proved to be a disappointment. How say you?
Yes, I think the actual results have disappointed in the first 3 years. A few things about Disney. The deal is valid for 100 years. The land grant is for 50 plus 50 years. So a lot of people ask me what's going to happen in 2047. And the answer is, well, I'm going to have my 99th birthday. That's really about what's going to happen. Nothing happens to the land. Every piece of land that the government sells this year, the lease will run till 2058. It's 50 years from a current date. So the Disney deal is valid, I think, for 100 years. It covers potentially 3 theme parks. What we have at the moment is about half of the first theme park. And there were certain expectations. There was a business plan. And so far, the business plan hasn't been achieved. And as a result, the original deal has been varied. That is, I think it's been publicized that Disney have given up certain of the royalties that they were entitled to receive in order to, and they've also paid off the bank loans, whereas it originally was the intention. I made a somewhat flippant remark earlier. Apart from the fact that dealing with Americans is very difficult because they're incredibly arrogant. I sometimes think I sometimes think that the reason I was selected to do the negotiations was because I, as someone who's been married twice, I was accustomed to humiliation. I learned to live with it. They did get some things wrong, but the good thing about Disney is that they do manage virtually all of the world's top theme parks. The list that came out recently, I see Dennis at the back, he wrote a story about it, managed to find a negative angle again, seeing that the attendance figures have gone up. Yeah, well done, Dennis. Hong Kong Disneyland is now in the top 20 in terms of attendance of theme parks in the whole world. Ocean Park is a little higher. Ocean Park, of course, is now, 30 years old? 35 years old? Compared to 3 years for Hong Kong Disneyland, and it's about 5 million attendance compared to Hong Kong's 4.5 last year. And of course, Hong Kong Disneyland doesn't get the pandas or the salamanders or what were those things that were eating each other? Oh, that was never mind. The Zeemans. I'm sorry, I lost the thread. I think the thing that Disney got right absolutely from day one was the quality of the park, the product, and the staff training. It's amazing. The quality of the live entertainment out there is fantastic. I was there 10 days ago. That's my fourth visit this year. We probably average once a month. Never much help with the kids. I love it. My granddaughter was there this week as well with my eldest son. So it's really, we enjoy it. I understand it's not everyone's cup of tea. But where they got wrong, I think there were issues in operations. We all remember those pictures of people climbing over the fence because they had a ticket valid for that day or being told they couldn't come in. Those problems were fixed very quickly. They had problems with the marketing. They assumed that people were more or less familiar with the Disney stories, and the marketing, the thrust was telling people that Hong Kong Disneyland was open, whereas in fact people weren't so familiar as they are in the West with the Disney stories. So they've now recast the marketing. It's much more effective. I think the big thing now is to accelerate the expansion of the park. They looked at the expansion timetable, realized it wasn't aggressive enough, and they've speeded, they poured proposals 2 years ago at Disney's expense to accelerate the expansion of the park. And my colleagues in the government have been looking at those proposals for 2 years. Don't ask me, partly because I'm not supposed to know, but I don't think that's good enough. I think we did the whole deal in 9 months. Tokyo took 5 years. Paris took 2.5 years. Hong Kong Disneyland was negotiated from start to finish in 9 months. And why it takes 2 years to negotiate an expansion of an existing park. Trouble is that people seem to have dug themselves a hole. The government's been so busy saying, making critical remarks. The LegCo members have been making critical remarks. And now, of course, they say, oh, but why are you going ahead with Shanghai then? And Disney said, well, wouldn't you? You've got money on the table, you've got the plans for the expansion, and you won't do a deal? We can't tie up all this capital. We want to address the China market. And the reason I pulled Steve's leg about this was Michael Eisner didn't help the Hong Kong government or me by telling a shareholders meeting that they'd been such good negotiators, they'd got Hong Kong to pay 90% of the cost of the park. This is a statistic that the governor, correspondent governor on my right, quotes religiously every time he writes about the subject. It's not true. It wasn't true when Eisner said it. It isn't true when Stephen writes it. But
well, what is the correct figure?
It's good. The correct figure is 57.43.
That's the equity shareholding.
That's the equity shareholding. Correct.
But in terms of investment, what is the correct figure?
That is the correct figure. There is a loan which is going to be repaid. There is a police station. There is a fire station. There is a public pier. There is a public transport interchange. Why wouldn't there be? Thousands of people go there every day. That was the highlight of the negotiations was the discussion about the landscaping on the roads approaching Disneyland and the landscaping inside the park. Because when Disney said they wanted to talk about landscaping, we couldn't think of anyone on the government side who could answer the questions or to bring into the team, because Hong Kong in those days didn't seem to focus very much on. By the way, we had a big problem with site selection for Hong Kong Disneyland, because on the one hand, you've got to be able to get thousands of people, tens of thousands, hopefully, through the front door every day, and you've also got to have it in a place that's remote, so it's divorced from reality. At one stage, we were going to put it in Lower Albert Road. When we talked about the landscaping, Disney said, we sat down, we finally found some girl who planted flowers in one of the parks in the New Territories, and she came and joined the Hong Kong government team for that session. And Disney began by saying, we'd now like to bring in the leader of the tree team. And we sort of, Christ, what's this? And it was species of tree, distance apart, how high the trees are to grow, how big is the crown, how deep are the roots, how is the tree going to be nurtured, how is the tree going to be watered. If the tree blows down in a typhoon, how quickly must it be re-erected? We spent 4 hours on trees. I think there's 17 or more pages in the final contract document about trees. And we thought, we got to lunch, thank God that's over. No, they said, after lunch, we'd like to bring in the leader of our bush team. And we did the whole thing again with the bushes. Luckily, okay. It wasn't George W.
We've got time just for one more quick question. There's a mic coming.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Given that you spoke about your desire to maintain small government in Hong Kong, why have you always felt so strongly against merging the trade promotion and the inward investment side of government, given how other governments around the world are merging those and given how there's quite a strong overlap in a lot of the areas that they do?
Thank you. It doesn't work. And the governments that do it find out that it doesn't work because the trade promotion always swallows the investment promotion. Austrade was split about a bit over 10 years ago, and an investment promotion agency was created, which was very successful. After the last election, Rudd merged them again, and Invest Austrade, or whatever it was called, is now one page on the Austrade website. The reason for that is the different constituencies. Trade promotion is winning more orders for the companies you've already got operating in your community. And therefore, it has a constituency which is right here, right now, talking to the head of the TDC, talking to the minister concerned, talking to the financial secretary. You must give this outfit more resources so they can go and win more orders for my toy factory in Guangdong. Right? Or my textile factory, which is also in Guangdong, but I pretend it's in Kuntong and stick the Made in Hong Kong label on the back before I ship it to America. So the trade promotion has a very forceful lobby. They're all in Hong Kong, they're all taxpayers, and they know who to talk to. The customers for investment promotion is nobody. By definition, those are the companies that are not here. And in fact, might not be thinking of coming here. So they are not haranguing the financial secretary or the minister for commerce. And they're not making a noise in LegCo. The only people who speak on their behalf, if you like, are broad-minded, intelligent chief executives. Don't worry, one day we'll get one. Remember, there's somebody in this room who is 40 years of age, 20 years resident of Hong Kong, and a Chinese national with no right of abode in any foreign country. Someone on this platform today is eligible for chief executive. So you either have a very broad-minded and intelligent chief executive and hopefully a financial secretary in the same way. And they are the whole of your constituency for investment promotion. Because investment promotion brings in new competitors. Therefore, they're not the same. And that's why, when they get in the same organisation, one swallows the other. And it's always trade that swallows investments. And in fact, the consultancy looked at 15, I think, 20 economies. How many was it? And only two do it merged. And the relevant international organisation recommends that you keep them separate for the very reason that I've just said.
Okay, we'll just do... Sorry, having said that was the last question, one last question from Francis.
Only because Steve's watch is 10 minutes fast. Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Mike, just an observation. First of all, I'm surprised to hear you say that all this stuff about the expansion of Disney or whatever is happening now. When it opened, I think virtually every reporter who covered that opening said, well, what they've got here is nice, but it's just way too small. I mean, that was the story for I think, many of us on the first day that it opened. So that's just my first thing. My second thought, a real question is to follow that, is this whole case of Lung Chin Wan and post-service employment, I'm wondering how you view that and whether it's had any effect on you and your options.
Oh, first of all, on Disney, we sold the joint venture company all the land we had. And we made no secret of how big it was. Land in Hong Kong is in short supply. It's a very crowded place. Most of the people who said it's not big enough didn't go there. I know that you're talking about reporters who were there on the day who did go. I find it compact, okay? And I'm not a real estate agent. We've been to most of the Disneys in the world, Tokyo, California, and Florida. And I'm under a lot of pressure to go to Paris this summer. But the first thing the kids want to do when we came back from Florida, was go straight to Hong Kong Disneyland. So is it small? Yes, it's smaller than the others. It will always be smaller than the others. Hong Kong doesn't have the land, and we sold them all the land we had, and we made no secret of it. But the fact is, we haven't used all the land yet, and the proposal that's on the table is to use more of it, and we should get the hell on and do it. Now, post-service employment. There are two absolutes here. One absolute. I didn't join the ICAC in 1974 so that we could clean up the city and then throw it all away again. One of Hong Kong's huge pluses is the Independent Commission Against Corruption. And it singles us out from most places in Asia. And therefore, we must have regard to that in anything we do about post-service employment. The second thing that we should look at is it's all about avoiding abuse of power, whether you call it corruption or transfer of benefits or what have you. It's all about abuse of power. Any system, then, should start with the conditions for the most powerful. And the most powerful now are the ministers. But they have subjected themselves to a much milder regime of post-service employment than they are attempting to inflict on civil servants. And they've just appointed Ron Arcully to devise an even tougher regime, but not for themselves, only for civil servants. This is rampant dishonesty. The abuse of power protection against should begin with a regime for the most powerful. Then you come to the civil service. In other jurisdictions, what you are concerned with is this transfer of benefits. So you tell people you cannot lobby in the area where you were working immediately before you left the government. In other words, you must keep a distance from things that you were intimately involved with where your position gives you an unfair advantage. But apart from that, you're free to do anything you want. Now, that may not be entirely suitable for Hong Kong. But I think the starting point, subject to the two conditions I've already listed, the starting point must be that we all have a right to work. It's amazing. I've heard LegCo members who normally shrieking from the rooftops about human rights. They obviously don't class civil servants as being human, because they're saying, and I've heard two of them say it on the radio, no civil servant should ever be allowed to work again. Two of our LegCo members I've heard on the radio saying that. And I haven't heard a single whisper from anyone holding an official position contrary to that. Why should they? The ministers won't speak because they're not subject to it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And totally unacceptable. Even the regime as it is probably subject to judicial review. And, of course, we know someone who's had a successful one of those. And we also know how much it cost him. So it's unlikely to pursue it in the near future. But I really would urge Ron, who is chairing this panel, no sliding back to pre-1974. That's absolute. It's not on the table. It's untouchable. But you must do a proper hierarchical structure. Start with the people who now are attending EXCO, who are intimately involved, who know all the information, are very, very influential, both in government and outside government when they eventually leave. Start with whatever regime they are subject to, and then cascade it down. And it's obviously less for more junior people. I, as it happens, am having a great time. If I had known how much fun retirement was, I would have retired years and years ago. I am working, in inverted commas, completely unpaid at two universities and having a fabulous time. I'm writing my book. I'm seeing more of my children. I have to see more of my wife as well, but, you know, every silver lining has a cloud. But it's a fabulous time. But the choice on whether I should carry on doing that or become an independent non-executive director of, I understand there are vacancies at PCCW. That choice is my choice. It's not Denise Yu's choice. It's not Mr. Justice Pang's choice. That's my choice.
Well, Mike Rouse, thank you very much. And I would like to make a small contribution on behalf of the FCC to your $3 million deficit with this priceless gift.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, it's
priceless.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to put it up for auction. The bidding starts at 2.9 million.
Thank you all very much.
No.